Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of Minorities in Publishing. This is Jen. For new and returning listeners, you may know you can find the podcast on Twitter at Minorities in Pub or on Tumblr at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com. And I'm super happy to welcome back Connor Goldsmith. Connor, Happy New Year.
I'm really excited to be back. I really love this podcast. And I actually looked back at the panel that I was on that became, I think, episodes 41 and 44. That was 3.5 years ago.
Yeah.
Can you believe how long ago that was? We got old. We're old.
I mean, it was when book culture still existed.
Oh, wow.
But I'm really psyched to talk to you because, as we mentioned, I've had a few agents on already, but I feel like there's still this mystique.
It's one of the more obscure sort of parts of the business. You do production editing, right? So, like, you understand that's also a very, people don't know that that exists, right? Agents, it's a little different because people know we exist because there's this sort of glamorous idea of it, and a lot of us are sort of public-facing. At this point, I have to think about what I say online because I have 13,000 Twitter followers. You know, a lot of writers follow me because they are looking to get an agent. So you sort of become almost a public figure without realizing it in a way that's a little strange. But yeah, I mean, so just to sort of introduce myself a little for people who don't know who I am, my name is Connor Goldsmith. I am a literary agent. I specialize in nonfiction, usually with a social politics bent, especially like quote-unquote minority subjects, or I do some celebrity books as well, but I always like for them to have some kind of hook in that is a little political. And I also specialize in sci-fi fantasy fiction for adults. So, and in that realm, I have sort of also been noted for specializing in LGBT stuff. I've been doing this for 7 years now.
Okay, 7 years completely meaning internships or part-time.
That's including everything, yeah. I started in 2012. I was an intern. Well, actually, if we really want to go back, because I do think that this, you know, in terms of people who ask, how did you break into stuff? I started in TV film agenting, which is what I thought I was going to do. Really hard to get a secure job in that business.
Really?
But I started as an intern there right out of college in 2010. So, and I got that internship because my uncle is an actor who taught at the time at Stone Street at NYU, and so he knew some of the agents, like, got me an internship because those, even the internships in the mailroom are competitive for those places. So I was there completely unpaid for a year at one of the, not the big five agencies, but like a mid-size, and they treated me well there, but it was unpaid. I am lucky enough that my parents live in this area, so, and I'm from here. I was lucky enough to be able to live at home and work for free for a while, and then I went to grad school, or to the New School for Media Studies, because I wasn't getting a job, and I thought maybe that having an MA in like Media Management and Media Studies would help. And while I was doing that, I wound up in an internship at a literary agency. Mine, it is an agency. The experience I had at the TV film agency gave me a resume that had some weight or whatever with the person I was interviewing with. And once I got there, I actually liked it a lot more because I found that TV film agenting, there wasn't a ton of creative control in it. Yeah, I mean, I was at a lower level. I mean, you get to pick which talent you work with, obviously, but when we would be calling out for auditions or things, it would just be, I don't know. There's a lot of stuff about that world that I just politically find kind of distasteful.
So was this for the people themselves, like the actors and actresses?
Yeah, it was what was more about like the way Hollywood works. The actors and actresses themselves were lovely people. The people I worked with at the agency were lovely people. But I don't know, an example I cited on Twitter recently is, so I'm Irish and Jewish, but I'm sort of like, visually, I sort of like quote unquote look Jewish, like I have sort of like an ethnically ambiguous look or whatever. And anyone with a look like that in cast would be put on a list called ethnic and all get sent out for the same audition. So it was Jews, Arabs, light skinned Latinos, dark skinned Italians, Greeks, Turkish people, Persians, like anybody who sort of fits in that, like, we're not exactly sure. And so that's why you would get lots of Jewish people in Latino parts, for example, or things like that, because they're all being sent out for the same. The example I always like to tell people is, so on Breaking Bad, there's this character, Hector Salamanca, who's played by a Jewish actor named Mark Margolis. The character's Mexican. And then there are these two characters named Margolis on the show, who therefore presumably are Jewish, because that's a Jewish name. But they're played by Kristen Ritter and John Delancey, who are WASPs. And all three actors are amazing, but like it just goes to show you that that kind of whitewashing thing really starts at the top and just kind of trickles down. Like at one point I was calling out auditions for My Big Fat Gypsy Wedding, which was like a show on E! And I every time I had to say the word, I was just like, I hate this. So it was like,
my face is cringy.
Yeah, I was like, let's call up any talent we know with like Romani heritage and ask them if they want to be on this show. Like, it's just like dark. You know what I mean? So, and that has nothing, it wasn't anything that the agency itself was necessarily doing wrong. It was just like the whole world. And like the way they talked about women's bodies, the way they talked about like gay actors who were too gay, things like that. It's just that sort of a culture there that I didn't like. Whereas in books, the second I got there, it was a lot. There's certainly, publishing's not perfect, which is part of why I think this podcast is so great, because there's a lot of stuff to dig deep about. But I did find it shockingly better. In that, as a literary agent, I choose all my own projects. I choose exactly what I'm working on. I find voices that I think are important, and then I get to use my proximity to whatever power to elevate those voices as much as I can. So as a gatekeeper, in whatever sense, I feel at the very least like I'm not doing something evil. I mean, and I work... And I, you know, I don't know. And I still, like, quite honestly, if I'd gotten a job in that world, I probably would still be there and just be, like, compromising myself every day. I have no idea. I can't really say. But I will say that I was, like, disquieted by that. And that what I do like about what I do now is that I really do have the prerogative to choose to work on what I want to work on and to put my name only behind work that I feel good about putting my name behind. And that doesn't mean that I'm perfect or that I don't pick things sometimes that people might end up objecting to or that might end up being controversial or whatever, because I'm human and I'm only one man. And especially if I'm working on POC subject, that's not an experience I have. So I can't guarantee that my like, oh, this seems great is going to be correct. But at the very least, I feel like I am helping.
You also own your privilege a lot too. We don't see, sometimes I see this in a performative way.
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't say I'm sure we
right.
see this in a performative way. But you've always been very open and transparent about where you've come from.
I just think that that's really important to do. And I feel this way sort of about the arts in general, because I think in the arts, sort of generally speaking, the pay is so poor in entry-level positions, and even not entry-level, but particularly in entry-level positions. And you either have to be in New York or LA, pretty much, to get started and to get trained, which are like two of the most expensive cities in this hemisphere to live in. You know, on your panel those 3 years ago, I remember the question that I was asked was sort of like, how can I break into this business? And I was the only white person on the panel. And I said, the thing is, this business is so stacked against you that it self-selects in, and this, I'm not saying this to discourage anyone, because I think anybody who wants to should try. And that certainly I know people, just talking to a friend of mine who like is Chicana and came from Texas with no money and worked a couple jobs and now is a successful editor at a big five house. But like I said to her, I don't know how you did that, because it's so crazy to me. Because I was born in Manhattan. My parents are attorneys. They met at Harvard Law. No pressure for me. They're like, do you want to go to law school? I was like, no, because I won't get into Harvard and then I'll feel weird. You guys met there. It's like weird. My dad did not grow up with a lot of money, but he has been successful. Like I said, I got my first job because my uncle, Zach Galligan, who's lovely, is the star of the movie Gremlins and was famous.
Yeah.
And, you know, was a pretty famous guy in the 80s. And now he still works, but he taught acting at NYU. And I told him I wanted to be a talent agent. He got me an internship at a talent agency. And I just don't like when people who have benefited from things like this, from family wealth, from being proximal to New York to begin with, from having connections in the industry, because the arts in general, a lot of the time, it is about favors. It is about saying, can you do this for me? Can you get me into this party so I can give people my business card and then I'll do you a solid in the future? And that's part of why it's hard when you're not here. And just being here is impossible. My first agency job with a salary was $27,000 a year, no benefits. And I didn't make a commission on anything because they said, we're paying you a salary. And this was in Manhattan. So if I hadn't had, at first, the ability to live at home, and then after that, I took out a loan from my parents, which I was able to do because my parents had money. You know, it's things like that where, I don't know, I just hate that kind of self-made rhetoric when it's not true. So I feel the need to kind of pull the curtain back on that, because it's a pet peeve of mine when people who also started like 10 steps ahead. And the thing is, there are people who started 20, 30, 40 steps ahead of me. But I think that it's important to just be open about that. And again, like I said on the panel, I was like, I don't want to discourage you from doing this if it's what you want to do with your life. I'm just telling you it's been really difficult, because it's been really difficult for me. I changed my whole branding this year because I was not making enough money to live on the commissions I was making from what I used to. I used to pretty much only represent sci-fi fantasy, and the books in that genre that are huge, but they're not that many of them. I mean, like, we don't all represent Game of Thrones, you know what I mean? You know, I had one nonfiction sale under my belt, which was Ziba Blay from the Huffington Post, who I've known for years. And we sold her book Carefree Black Girls, which should be coming out in 2021, which is just sort of like a survey of Black it girls of the 20th century. It starts with Josephine Baker and goes up through Rihanna and talks about which Black women were allowed to be iconic in the culture that white people dictated, right? It talks about sort of like stereotypes and archetypes and the way that growing up as a Black woman in America, she sort of internalized those and what good things and bad things there are about like Pam Grier in the 70s or about these characters in the 90s and things like that. So it's a really fascinating book. But I'm just saying, I sold that because Ziba was my friend and I went to her and I was like, do you want to write a book? Because you're smart, you have a platform, and I think you're bringing something to the table that hasn't necessarily been in the book marketplace before. Because there is an underserved, you know, it's funny, someone recently said to me, Connor, you're like signing every Black woman in New York. And I said, I'm fine with it. Here's the thing. I have like 30 odd clients. And at this point, 5 of them are Black female cultural critics. And I find that there's a misconception. I mean, I guess I would call it a misconception because I don't think it's true. But there is sort of a conventional wisdom sometimes about any minority book. This includes LGBT stuff or even religious minority stuff. Just that you're sort of competing with yourself at a certain point because the idea is that publishers will only buy a certain number of those books. And so it becomes like Highlander, where there can be like only one, and there's a lot of sort of internal competition within each minority group to be like one gay book or Jewish book or whatever that gets a lot of attention that year. And so people were sort of surprised that I this year signed several women who, of course, it turns out all know each other, which has been fun. I represent Ive Ani, who's a music critic. I represent Shamir Ibrahim, who's a culture critic. I just announced that I'm working with Nejma Sharif, who is also a culture critic. To me, I was just saying this to one of them and like a holiday thing I did for my clients. I don't see this as competition. You're all writing different books and you're all individual different people. And frankly, there are studies on this. Black women read more percentage-wise per capita and buy more books than any other group in America. So my job is to convince the publisher that there's a market. And that's really what agents are here to do. I think part of what's been tricky for me on occasion is that I have gone for projects that are maybe a little more off the beaten path. But I think that if I believe in something and the person can produce it, then it can sell. So I guess all of this is a very roundabout way of saying I feel like I have a proximity to power and whiteness and wealth and whatever else that I was born with. And I would like to use that as best I can to help elevate voices that maybe don't always have that access. And that's sort of my, I guess, raison d'etre as an agent. But at the same time, like, it has to be a business, right? So it becomes about brand development. It becomes about all of these nitty-gritty, awful things. You know, let's put together this book proposal. Who is everyone famous you know who we can say might help you promote the books? And that sucks. But part of why you have an agent is that we get to do all of that really unfortunate, unpleasant stuff, and you get to just write a book and not have to spend all your time asking people for favors, which, as I said, again, is how this business operates a lot of the time.
Is 30 a lot for an agent?
It depends. I don't have numbers in my head because I also, like, they may have changed by the time this airs. But I would say, like, right now I have, like, maybe 10 to 12 fiction clients. I've switched to taking fiction only on referral because I quite honestly can't have too many more than that just because I'm very editorial and a fiction manuscript is a lot of work. Whereas nonfiction, which is my other 20-odd clients at this point, they sell on proposal, those books. Most of the time anyway. Memoir, sometimes you need the whole thing, but usually a nonfiction book sells on proposal. And so that's just a more manageable workload for me. Also, with some people, it's just one book, like with a celebrity client. Like, I represent Amy Borman, who coached Simone Biles and Ali Reisman and coached them all at Rio to the Gold and was one of the She was the only coach to publicly speak out during the Nassar scandal and all that stuff. So she's working on a memoir that's really, really cool. And I'm very excited about it. Like, I think that's the only book she intends to write. You know what I mean? Is like her memoir. So that in nonfiction, you sometimes have a one and done like that, which is easier as opposed to having like an ongoing career. But for my nonfiction authors like Ziba, who I'm sure will write many books, it's still editing with her 100-page proposal is very different from editing a novel. It's just, I can do more of that. So I would say in terms of on average, I don't know, because it really varies by agent and what your agenting style is, how much personal attention you give to every client. I mean, I don't have an assistant because I can't pay one. And I refuse to have an unpaid intern or anything like that because I did that and I don't think it's right. So I just don't, which means it's all me. So yeah. I would say I would love to have 50, but if I did that, I would probably only add like 4 or 5 more in fiction, just because I don't think I can do that many novels each year. And like, I have some fiction clients who sent 4 manuscripts this year. Which one do you like? And I go, oh my God. Like, you know, and I'm thrilled that they're so productive, but then it's like, all right, let me read all 3 of these. Let me discuss with you which one I think is the most marketable in this moment. Let's work on editing it for 6 months and let's send it somewhere. Which is just a lot of man hours on one client, which is also why going to referral was really important, because I just like couldn't keep track of my query inbox anymore. Like if you look at my page on Query Tracker, it's like a lot of people, which is a website where people Yelp review agents basically who they've queried. My Query Tracker page, I looked at it once and I was just like, I can never look at this again. Because it was all just people like, I never heard from this guy. I'm like, I'm sorry, you didn't. My bad.
But it's Rate My Professor.
Basically, yeah. Which like I think is an important resource. I think it's important. And there's a great site called Absolute Right where people talk about really bad experiences they have with agents. And it was never anything horrible. It was just like, I queried him a year ago and I haven't heard back. I'm like, yep, sorry. Because that's the least pleasant part of the job for me is rejecting people. I hate doing it. And so then it would like build up and then I would look at it and I would be like, oh my God, there's 1,000 emails in this inbox. And then I would be like, okay, I'll do that tomorrow. And then you just wouldn't do it tomorrow. You know what I mean? So it's easy to lose track of time when you're managing a lot of different people's careers and you're responsible for these people and their success.
I didn't realize there was the Absolute Right thing. I know about Query Tracker and I love Publishers Marketplace.
Well, PM's great, but it's so expensive. Yeah. Talk about another access problem.
Yeah, 25 a month.
Yeah.
Minimum.
You can, and
tax write-off.
Right, but if you don't work in publishing, it's not a tax write-off. You know what I mean? Like, and I...
But these are valuable sources to
absolutely. If you can afford a Publishers Marketplace subscription, I absolutely recommend you have one. So that you can see what agents... See what I sold, what I represent. Although I will say,
all your people who said
it lists all my deals. I will say I have lots of things that are in development that I can't put on PM until they're announced. So that sometimes it's not the most accurate gauge. And if you look up an agent and they only have 1 or 2 sales, I had to. And I was lucky to have. I had to have people take a chance on me when I was new. Because if you don't have a sales track, you have nothing to show for yourself. But those people also have much smaller client lists. So they have more time to devote to you specifically, which can sometimes be exactly what you need. But yeah, I mean, if you look at PM, I think right now I have like 13 deals listed, which bothers me because I'm superstitious. And in 7 years, now only 5 of those years have I been a full-time agent. I was an assistant before that.
And being assistant means you weren't acquired?
I was, because... That really varies by agency. So I had clients, but I didn't sell anything because I was mostly assisting and I only had like 3 clients and I had more time to edit and I had taken on projects that I was like, this is amazing, but let's really like dig into it because we're going to turn it into something incredible. And we did. And I've been doing this full time since 2014. And like those 13 deals, a lot of them are multi-book deals. So if you have a client, if a deal is 3 books, it only shows up once though on PM if I sold a trilogy. So, and that trilogy then takes the author like 4 years to complete. So, but it's like that client is under contract. That client is handled. And for a long time, I only had 12 clients because I was doing mostly fiction and I was very picky. And because it's not just about whether something's good, it's also about whether I love it enough to really advocate for it on a deep level. Because my job a lot of the time is calling up editors and being, hi, just checking in on this book that I'm obsessed with that you've been reading for 8 months. What do you think about it? Right. Well, but they're busy too. You know what I mean? Like our job is to curate for them so that they're just not just reading the naked slush pile like Query Inbox, but that doesn't mean they don't have 40 manuscripts on their desk that they have to get through.
Or that they read at work at all.
Or exactly, because they have tasks to perform. That's the other thing about the Query Inbox. It's like I was always trying to explain to people, is I do that when I have free time. Most of my time is spent editing, reading, interfacing with editors, interfacing with publicists, working on proposals, working on all kinds of things that do not give me a free moment to sit in a Query Inbox and read stuff that usually I'm not gonna want. Not because, again, not because it's bad, but just because it's such a subjective taste thing.
Publishing.
That's life, right?
On the workout.
Yeah, and especially when you're assisting as well, because most of the time then you're working on your boss's clients, whether you're an agent or an editor, you know, because there's just so much that needs to be done there that it's hard to get your own list going. And especially in agenting, there are some agenting jobs that are salaried, but usually only if you're assisting or if you also do foreign rights or something else like that, like for the agency. I work entirely on commission, for example, which most agents do.
So you touched on something else that I was eager about is the salary, because you mentioned when you started.
Well, the reason
you got a salary but weren't able to get
it. I left because I got a job offer that I was really pleased about. So there was that. And I'm very, very happy at Fuse. And Lori McLean and Gordon Warnock have been really, really supportive and brilliant in my career development and helping me and all of that. But I would say that the reason I left and like I took out that loan, like I said, from my parents, I mean, the salary was a pittance, right? Like,
that's what I got as an editorial assistant in 2004.
And this was 2012-13. It was just not livable. And because of the salary, I was not going to receive any commission on anything I sold. And I was like, that's not a way I can build a sustainable business. So I went to Fuse, where there was no salary, but where they had a very generous, it was a very generous split in terms of the 15% that the agency takes, in terms of what the agent was taking home versus what the agency was taking. Because a lot of agencies just split at 7.5, right down the middle. But that means that those agents are living on 7.5% of every book that they sell, and that's it. There's no salary, there's no... Sometimes there's benefits, but, you know, I'm more like a contract employee. I don't have included benefits. Just financially speaking, it's difficult, and it becomes almost a volume game because you have to have enough projects going out that your chunk of the 15% commission is something you can live on. And not every book is a hit. So you could spend a year and a half working on something that then doesn't end up making a lot of money. And I don't think of any book as a failure. That's not sort of how I conceptualize things, but in terms of whether I'm paying rent, it's relevant. So there is sort of a need to bulk up your client list, to develop more talent. Part of the pivot to nonfiction for me was I know my brain and how I work and all of that. And I know that I can do more of this each month than if I need to sit down and do a full fiction editorial. I love working on fiction. Mm-hmm. It's just very time consuming. So I was like, this is something I can do more of. And the other thing about nonfiction is that because a lot of the time it's platform based, a lot of the time with nonfiction, I'm approaching the talent rather than waiting for the talent to come to me, or I'm getting referred the talent by people I already represent, or things like that. So once you have had some success in nonfiction, it becomes easier because people have heard of you and they will refer their colleagues to you and things like that, and you start to get business sort of organically in that way. Whereas fiction, it really is, okay, you got a novel. I mean, sometimes it's a referral, obviously, mm-hmm. if someone knows another writer or they taught someone or whatever. But in general, it's, okay, here's a novel manuscript, read it and see if you like it, which is just a very, again, just in of itself, more time-consuming process. So it's been an interesting pivot. I was really scared about it because I didn't know if I could do it. And I really did this year. Like, I sold Ziba's book and I was like, okay, that was kind of exhilarating and fun, and I did it in a relatively brief period from actually sitting down. We'd worked together for a long time, but she was like, okay, it's time to do a book. And I was like, great, okay, I'm excited. And like, you know, we spent a couple months putting the proposals together, and then we sold it in a couple months because proposals don't take that long for the editors to read. I was like, okay, if I want to continue doing these huge fantasy novels that take me a really long time to edit, which I do because I love doing them, I was like, I also need to have a steady sort of stream of less labor-intensive proposal work to do that I can sell year-round, sort of. And so this year I've assigned like 20 nonfiction clients, all of whom I really adore and think are important, incisive, great voices, but it is more math. I couldn't possibly have taken on 20 novels this year. That's not something that possible. A lot of it is about time management. It is about trying to figure out, because you only have so many hours in a day and so many weeks in a year. And like right now, we're recording toward the end of December and publishing's done until mid-January now. In July and August, publishing's pretty much low. You only have like a good 9 months of the year anyway. So I don't know. It's about balancing your workload and figuring out what works for you, and also doing work that satisfies you creatively, because otherwise it's just a 9-to-5 job that you hate, which, especially when you work from home, which I do, is really difficult, because when you aren't structured in like a 9-to-5 way, it's hard to actually make yourself do work you don't like doing. So it's really important that every project you're working on is something you're passionate about, because then you're excited to sit down and work for 3 hours in your living room or kitchen or whatever, when you could just be watching The Real Housewives. You know what I mean? Because like, you have to be disciplined if you're working from home. There's no one leaning into your office to make sure you're working.
People keep emphasizing to me I should negotiate more to work from home. You don't understand.
It does not work for some people. It truly does not.
It does for my writing.
Well, for me, it's really nice because I'm working with more celebrity talent these days. And so a lot of that is out in LA. And so I've been spending more time in LA. And it's nice to be able to work from anywhere. Or I'm going not to every stop, but I have a client, Kristen Doty from Vanderpump Rules, her book is coming out next June, and we're going to do like a tour, and I'm going to go to a couple of the events around the country because I want to help her with stuff. I can still work even if we're in Detroit for a couple of days. That flexibility I really like, but it does mean that there's less structure on you to just like force yourself to work. So it requires a certain level of discipline. And I think that being excited about everything you're working on is a good way to keep yourself sort of focused.
So is that kind of quote unquote normal for an agent to kind of go with their client?
It depends on the book project. I mean, and like, I don't have an expense account, so it's more about like what I can, especially with a celeb talent who it's their first book, they don't know the publishing world. I like to be there in case like booksellers have questions or whatever, and I do that. And I can do that on the phone, but it's also, it's really fun to go and watch fans come in to be excited to get the book and to meet. So I'm looking forward to that. And I'm really proud of that book. She worked on it with Michelle Alexander, who wrote How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. They've been friends for years, and Kristen's never written a book, and Michelle wrote a very successful book. So they've been sitting down and they've just been working their asses off together and putting this thing together. And she gets really real about really real stuff in her life that you didn't see on television. And I think a lot of women and gay men, knowing her fan base like me, will relate to. And I think it's important. I think it's an important book. So, or like I represent the Boulay brothers, who have that show Dragula, which is sort of like an alt drag race that's a little more avant-garde. And I think what they're doing is important for the LGBTQ communities, even if that book isn't more in peace. I think it's doing something important. I think it's moving a conversation forward. And yeah, so I wouldn't say it's normal for an agent to go on a book tour, but the fact that I work from home means that if I have a client who doesn't know the publishing world particularly, and it would be useful for me to attend 3 or 4 things over the course of a couple months, I have the flexibility to be able to do that, which is nice. But it really all comes down to what you can afford, what makes sense, what other work you're doing, what other clients you have things for that at that time. I'm gonna be in LA for most of January, and I had to budget that in with events I have to do in New York. I'm gonna miss this mixer that I wanted to go to with some editors because I'm gonna be in Los Angeles, but I wanted to be in Los Angeles because it's awards season and some of my clients will be doing stuff that I want to see or to be around for or to support them or whatever else. It's a balancing act like anything else. I think that what comes across, I guess, as mysterious, I don't know, it's like being an agent is this thing, whenever you see it on TV or in like a movie or something, it's very like da-da-da-da-da-da on the phone and like these very sort of like in these nice suits and like they're these sharky, high-powered people who, I will say like the most...
What's that show?
Entourage. Yes. Sort of the most favorite. Yes. But I would say like the most accurate to my experience, although I haven't seen most of the show because it's honestly, it like depresses me too much and I can't do it, but do you watch BoJack Horseman?
I have watched BoJack Horseman.
Yes, the Princess Carolyn character, the Amy Sedaris character on that show, who's like his agent. I really relate to that character, which is dark. It is most of the time just this like, very mundane day-to-day bullshit where you're just, I am going to scrape my way into some event that I shouldn't probably be at so that I can give my business card to so-and-so so that I can tell them about my client so that maybe they'll blurb my client in 6 months. Like, it's not that glamorous a job. It's just, it's a job that it's very easy to make it look glamorous on Instagram, which is helpful because that itself is sort of a brand development. Oh my God, I'm at this party. But it's like, I'm at this party because I am desperate to speak to one person who I couldn't get a hold of through their manager or whatever, you know? It's, I don't know. I love my job and I'm very lucky to have a job that I love, but I do think that if people saw how actually boring and tedious a lot of it was, it would make them laugh because it is mostly spreadsheets. And long conference calls. Yeah. Yeah. So that's what, I mean, people always say, why is there no publishing reality show? It's because too much stuff is NDA'd. B, it's so slow that there would be nothing. I mean, like days go by when nothing happens. You're just like, you just call 20 different people and go, hey, I'm just following up on this. They can leave a voicemail, but like they don't get back to you for 3 days. So it's not like there would be no, it would only work insofar as drama between people in the office, but the actual job itself would not be interesting to watch. It's not like a restaurant. There are just so many like
sports or
like where it's like these people are in close quarters all the time running around doing stuff. We're mostly sitting at a desk waiting for someone to call us back, which is mostly just irritating and would not be fun to watch.
Aggressiveness too.
Yeah, absolutely. On the editor side, I'm sure you get that too. It's like very much, okay, when are they going to send us back these pages or whatever? And just like, we're like, when is the contracts department going to get back to us? That's like not compelling television. But I feel like we hear that all the time because we're like, oh my God, it's the arts. It's just not that interesting. The only way to make it interesting is to really like, there's that show Younger that's sort of about publishing. But
which is so fake.
Exactly. Like nothing that happens on it is anything like the real, which I guess we're not unique in that sense. My father in particular like cannot watch any legal show because he's just like, this is ridiculous. He's like, this isn't how trial works. I'm like, Dad, please stop. It's hard to talk about this without feeling like I'm like bragging or being performative in some way, but I do really value the opportunity to get work out there from people who are from underserved communities. Like that really is something that I feel passionate about, and it makes me feel like I've done something good with my time. And there's nothing really more satisfying than feeling like the work you put into something has done something that will be important for people.
So do you think, as an agent, and I'm not trying to get you in trouble here.
No, of course.
But that's what people should be looking for in the agent, is to make sure their agent loves what they do and has a natural nurturing ability.
Yeah, for their work. And listen, I've parted ways with clients, they've parted ways with me or whatever, because we haven't vibed right. Or we did for years, and then suddenly they sort of, not so suddenly, but you know what I mean? Like they went into a new year and were like, you know, I'm not sure this approach is really working. And that is always sad when a relationship doesn't work out like that. The most important thing for you as the writer is that you feel like you trust the agent's point of view on your work. You trust that you guys are seeing eye to eye on strategy. You trust that you guys are seeing eye to eye on everything else, and that you feel supported. And sometimes a great agent is not the right agent for you. And I think that I'm obviously biased, but I think you should have an agent. There's lots of debate about that. I think it's important you should have a middleman who can be your advocate, so that who can look at a contract and see if there's any predatory clauses in it, who can be the person who calls your editor and says, look, we have a problem with the cover, so that you don't have to get in a fight with your editor, because that serves no one. Who can be sort of the bad cop to your good cop. Not that either of us should be cops, but you know what I'm saying. And I think that that is a personality mesh. It's a process mesh. There's a lot of different things that go into that. While I think that you should have one, I think it's more important to have one that you feel comfortable with and that you are happy with, because we are taking 15%. And if we're not doing what you want us to be doing, then you should find someone who is. And also, this is just something I always say when I'm talking to agents. You do not pay agents. I really do feel the need to stress that. People know that, but sometimes someone does. There are a lot of scammers out there who will say they're an agent and they want you to pay them a reading fee or whatever. It's complete bullshit. You do not pay an agent. I do not get paid by any of my clients unless it's something specific, like I need to mail out some manuscripts to the translator for like a foreign, you know, and that they get billed the $12 or whatever, you know what I mean? But they don't pay me for my services. That comes purely from the publisher. And if anyone is asking you for money, that's a red flag. And you should not do that, because that's not how this business is supposed to work. We work for you. Now, I know that sometimes it doesn't feel that way because there is a complicated power dynamic, because everyone's desperate to have an agent. And then when they have an agent, they worry that they're going to lose their agent or whatever. But at the end of the day, we are on your team. And so like, A, you shouldn't be paying us, and B, you should be happy with our performance. It's just really important to make sure that you're on the same page with
all of them. And how would you recommend, because this comes up a lot, mm-hmm. is how do people break up with their agents? Like, how do you about that?
Luckily, it's only happened to me 4 or 5 times, which is, you know, because it's hard.
I don't know the numbers.
Yeah.
I broke up with my first agent.
It's very common. And I'm very lucky in that almost all of mine have been pretty amicable. Personally, I like to get on the phone, but I know not everybody likes the phone. For me, I like to have conversations with people, and if I can't meet them in person, it's nice to talk on the phone. But sometimes it's awkward and you don't want to do that, so an email is fine. But I tend to think if you're having a lot of doubts, you've probably already kind of made up your mind. I don't think there's one good way to do it, but what I've always really appreciated, I'll say, when people have left, is when they've sent me an email that says, hey, I hope we can be cool, but I'd like to move on. Here are sort of the issues I've had over the last couple months or whatever. Because then it helps me to do better at my job. If someone says that they felt I wasn't communicative enough or whatever, that's just like throwing an example out there that one might hear about.
That's been a universal one.
Yeah, well, because like, again, because
say, I haven't
it's
heard from
well,
my agent for months.
Because, yeah, and that is crazy to me. If you haven't heard from your agent for months, I really try always to get back to people within 48 hours if they email me about something. That's not to say that I'll be like, yes, I've read it, but like to answer the email.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? That's an example. Mm-hmm. If someone said to me, like, I just feel like, you know, I didn't get enough communication from you about submissions or whatever, mm-hmm. that's good for me to know, because then in the future with other clients, I'll just make a point of, if I think I've been communicative enough, maybe I could do one extra thing or something. Just like, mm-hmm. you know, so I appreciate notes. It's like when you're a writer, I imagine that much as they can be upsetting to read, a longer editorial rejection that gives you feedback is more useful than a, not for me. Because if it says your world building doesn't work, then that's like something to fix. Or if it says, I just don't like the character, and you get that note 30 times, well, maybe there's something that has to change. I'm lucky and this hasn't happened to me a lot. And when it has happened, it's been sad. I'm on good terms. I pretty much everybody I've parted ways with, as far as I know. It really does just come down to a comfort level thing, because this is a very intimate relationship. They are entrusting me with their career. And I think that's a huge responsibility. I know that whenever people ask this question, there are a lot of like unrepresented writers who would be like, I'm just trying to get one. And obviously it's a ladder, right? And you have to climb all these different rungs of this stupid ladder to get your tradition accomplished in any case. But I think that it is a real thing that people need to think about, because a lot of writers I know are on their second or third agent. There's nothing wrong with that at all. From the agent end, I'm like, no, but like, it's not unusual. I don't think it says anything necessarily about the writer or the agent. It's just like, sometimes you grow apart. Sometimes you just, the vibe isn't right. And like, that is important, because you really do need to feel comfortable with each other. You need to feel comfortable. I need to feel comfortable that I can give you notes. I need to feel comfortable that I'm communicating with you in the way that you like. And you need to feel comfortable that I'm handling your finances in a way that you approve of, in terms of giving you information on your royalty statement. It's just a thing where if you're not trusting each other, it isn't going to work. And that's one reason. Another reason, I'm not sure that we have the same vision for my career going forward, which is totally a thing that happens. I'll be like, I think you should do this thing next. And the writer's like, that's not really what I'm interested in doing. Okay. And they're like, and I think I'd like to find someone else. Like, that's totally reasonable.
Yeah. I think it's when someone sees something,
they assume that there's a big dramatic mess. And a lot of the time that's not the case. It's just sort of, this wasn't working out. And my agency agreement, or Fuse's agency agreement generally, is like very flexible that way, because I've been at places where you're locked in for a long time, if you saw it, a couple of years or whatever. And I don't think that it's a good idea. That's the more old school way of doing it. I am more into the idea that if someone wants to leave, I should just get to wrap up what I'm working on, and then they should be free to go, because I don't think you should hold people captive if they don't want to work with you anymore. But I don't know. It is like any other relationship, like a friendship or a romantic relationship or anything else, where sometimes things just end and it's not anyone's fault. At the very least, it's not anyone's fault in a way where like anyone's mad at each other.
So in Twitter drama,
oh gosh,
you remember that piece, there was the woman who was blaming her agent, remember? And she had big deal initially, and she said, my agent didn't tell me this. And some people were of the camp of, why didn't you ask?
So if you were unfamiliar and you didn't, it was this woman who, and I don't do kids' books, so it was a slightly different scenario from what I'm used to, but basically this woman had gotten a big six-figure deal, and then an advance, rather, and had sort of frittered it all away, and was sort of saying that the agent hadn't prepared her for how that getting a six-figure deal doesn't mean that you're just now making a six-figure income.
Even as you re-explained it, I'm like, what the hell?
That's it. I was confused, because I went on Publisher's Marketplace and I looked up who the agent had been, and the agent's like a very reputable agent. I was just sort of like, I'm not sure I believe this. You know, I just was sort of like, maybe you weren't listening. The idea that she wouldn't have explained to the author what earning out in advance means, that doesn't seem plausible to me. That's one of the first conversations I have with, is making sure that the writer understands what an advance is, just in case they have to pay it back, which is unusual, very unusual. But sometimes this shit like that can happen, because you can't finish the book because of some circumstance. Okay. You know what I mean?
But not if you have.
No, if you finish the book, you get your advance. But also, if you get a six-figure advance and then your book is not a success, you're never going to see royalty, because you haven't earned out the advance. That's just something that people have to know, even if it's not six figures. If I sell a book for $75,000, I say to the person, just FYI, make sure you save some of this for a rainy day, because there's no way of knowing whether you're going to earn this out. And if you don't, the next advance is not going to be that big. It'll be smaller than that. Or not always. It's not always one-to-one like that. But you get what I'm saying. Like, I found that to be a very strange affair. And I was just kind of like, I'm not calling you a liar, but I feel like you somehow like didn't understand conversations you have with me. Because it was such basic stuff that I was just really
baffled. Okay, so that is basic
baffled.
Stuff that
yeah,
agent
like,
would say.
I think so. Like, explain to you what earning out means and how royalties work. I just feel like that's very simple. There are confusing things. I will say, when I was first starting out, I was very confused by the reserve against returns, because it's super complicated to wrap your head around it.
Okay.
Which is basically, they hold some money in reserve for people who are listening who don't know. Like, the publisher holds some money in reserve in case people return the book.
Yeah, which happens.
Which happens, for sure. Bookstores return books. But explaining to my authors the first few years I was an agent, like, and here's when you'll get that money, I found that very confusing. And that was me learning on the job. Oh, okay, here's how this works. I get it now. And certainly, like, we grow together, the agent and the author, if you start out with someone who is newer, because we run into new situations. Like, if I have to negotiate with someone about a cover because we hate the cover and I've never done that before, I'm gonna have to figure out how to do it. That's part of the trust, right?
I mean, I'm also in a privileged position because I work in publishing.
And
so
you
know
how things work, right?
So I'm like, but then I'm stepping back and being like, is this something that
I can't imagine not explaining to someone how royalties work. Like, I just...
Yeah, my first agent, she seemed like the type of person. She doesn't work in the industry anymore.
Gotcha.
But she seemed like the person who wouldn't communicate that. So if she had had my agent, I think I would be like... Yeah,
but I'm just saying, this was a good agent. Like, yeah, this was someone you go on PM, it's like a real person with a lot of sales.
You and Linda Camacho and Patrice. I'm like, I know you guys.
I just was like, I'm not, right. Like, and again, like, I'm not saying I'm perfect. I have on occasion made a mistake or explained something wrong because I misunderstood something or whatever. But like, and that happens. Like, that's life.
Yeah.
But you don't make royalties until you earn out your advance is such a basic concept of a book deal that I just truly...
No,
and the idea that starting at six figures doesn't mean you stay at six figures for every book deal you get from now on.
Yeah.
That is also really, to me, seems like something obvious, because if your book's not successful, there are sales numbers that the publisher looks at and they're not be like, all right, let's try again. Like, that's not, you know, they might try again, but not for the same amount of money. I don't know. It's just, that was a weird situation. I did also kind of feel bad for the author because it became this big tempest in a teapot on Twitter. And Twitter is a nightmare. So...
But Twitter also forgets. I don't know that everyone on Twitter forgets.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm not sure. I think Twitter's like an elephant sometimes, quite honestly. I don't know. Twitter, what partly built my career, so I feel very indebted to it. Mm-hmm. Part of the reason I got my job at Fuse when I didn't have any sales yet, because I hadn't sold anything as an assistant at my previous agency, was that Lori was like, we really love your social media presence and we're trying to be sort of a more modern forward agency and we like that you're so active and talking to people. Also, I work from home. I wouldn't know what was going on in the world because I'm not turning on cable news. I would rather die. I know what happens in the world because it like trends on Twitter. You know, so I have it open in a tab basically whenever, and I have been, I guess, lucky enough or maybe just like, sort of naturally inclined toward it as a medium. Like, I'm bad at Instagram. I'm like really bad at Instagram, but Twitter, for whatever reason, I say some stupid thing off the cuff and people think it's funny or relatable or whatever. So that's been really helpful to me, but at the same time, it also is really just awful. I mean, like, the access it allows anybody with an opinion to tell you their opinion is really rough. So I think that that author didn't anticipate how much attention like random Medium post was gonna get, so I did feel bad for her about that. Overall, I think that engaging is just usually a mistake, and I feel like most Twitter conflicts happen because you didn't just ignore it. I mean, sometimes it's like, just apologize and never say anything about it again. Like, just move on with your life. Like, really, like, especially if you realize that you were in the wrong, like, it's just like, just move along.
Connor, for being on. This has been so fun.
This has been really fun. First of all, I wanted to congratulate you on the PW Star Watch.
Oh, thank you.
And I was really thrilled about that because I do think the work you're doing is really important. Thank you for having me on. I will say it makes me feel like I'm doing something right to have people who are doing important work like you feel that I'm doing something right. So like, when you're like, you're a good example of someone who I think is a good ethical agent to have on my podcast, it's like, I love that. Like, love that for me. Thrilled to hear it. But I want to thank you for that opportunity. If anybody listening is interested in knowing a little more about me or about my client list, I have a personal website at connorgoldsmith.com. Connor like Sinead O'Connor, Goldsmith like a jeweler, C-O-N-N-O-R. And you can also see all my colleagues and all of our clients at FuseLiterary.com. On Twitter and Instagram, I am Dream of Organon, which is Dream of O-R-G-O-N-O-N. It's a Kate Bush lyric. Sorry, I didn't know I was going to be professional, and then the name Connor Goldsmith was taken by some teenager who hasn't tweeted since like 2005, and I can't get it. It's really frustrating, but it's fine.
Are you on manuscript wish list too?
It's really out of date, especially because it's all fiction and I'm not taking fiction right now unless it's a referral. But I think manuscript wish list is great. For me, I haven't updated it in a really long time, and at this point, I would say just generally, again, with fiction right now, I am requiring a referral just because I can't take too much more of it on right now. But a referral can be as much as like we spoke on Twitter and I said, yeah, sure, send me that. I don't want to cut people off access-wise. I just need to stem the flow a little bit because I can't manage too much more. I would say in general, what I am looking for is, like, I love stuff that is, that feels like I've never read anything like it before. And it's hard to define that. But
for both genres.
Yeah, for fiction and nonfiction. When I read an essay and I'm like, God, this made me think about something I've never thought about this way before. Like, that's the kind of person I want to do an essay collection with, you know, things like that. And a lot of the time that does tie into minority experiences, because I certainly don't know what it's like to be, like, a trans woman. So, like, reading a really interesting essay by a trans woman about transition, like, makes me like, huh, I haven't read something told in this way about this experience. And then I am like, okay, well, how could this turn into a bigger project? Like, what is this person's platform? Things like that. So that's sort of like my manuscript wish list in general, is if it's something that feels different or that feels urgent, like it moves the conversation forward, or that it represents people who haven't been adequately represented. Like, that's sort of what I've always been about. Look on my website or at the Fuse website or on Twitter or Instagram or my Facebook page, which is like public when it's about clients, and that's facebook.com/Con Gold, I think.
Thank you again, Connor.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
You can follow the podcast at Minorities in Pub on Twitter and minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com. And we are on Spotify, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Google Play, and iTunes.
Like, which, everywhere.
Yeah.
Good show.
Yeah. I think it's Apple Podcast or something now. Because
I think it's
like,
I think it's Apple Muse or Apple. It used to be iTunes, but it's not anymore.
Yeah,
I'm a Windows person, so I'm not
Google Play
super up on.
It's not. It's on your freaking iPad.
No. It's like the thing that's on your iPad. All right. Well, thank you again for having me. This was really, really
Thanks
fun.
Thanks so much.